Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
So October marks National Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month. First and foremost, if you are someone who has experienced a miscarriage or losing a child in infancy, from the bottom of my heart, I am so sorry. I, too, experienced a miscarriage 1 year ago, actually. It completely rocked our world. We are still kind of dealing with that in some ways today. But, you know, it's incredible what I've learned in the last year, especially how hard it is to start or to grow a family and how common it is to have pregnancy problems. Health experts actually say miscarriages happen in 1 in 4 recognized pregnancies. Wow. To talk a little bit more about this is Dr. Ronica Chowdhury. She is affiliated with Bridgeport Hospital and St. Vincent's Medical Center. She actually has her own gynecology practice in Trumbull and Fairfield. And doctor, thanks for coming on this morning. We're glad to have you back on the show. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by saying I understand the figures of 1 in 4 women will have a miscarriage, which is unbelievable. But, you know, how common is it for pregnancies to just go wrong?
You know, it's a lot more common than most women know of. You know, when a woman gets pregnant, she never really anticipates that the pregnancy is not going to go to completion and that she's not going to hold that baby. But we know that the incidence of an early pregnancy loss in the first trimester can be as high as 31%. A lot of pregnancies aren't realized, but in the last couple of decades with early detection with pregnancy home tests that start working, you know, more effectively at an earlier gestation and then blood work and ultrasounds, women know that they're pregnant a lot earlier than they used to. And so we find that that also contributes to the increased number of early pregnancy losses.
Okay, so I guess that kind of answers my second question, which was that, you know, have we always had these issues? You know, have miscarriage numbers and unhealthy birth numbers, have they been the same decade over decade? Or is it that we're talking about it more, we have early testing more? You know, is that the reason we're seeing it? Or has it always been, a problem?
It's always been a problem. There was a great study that was done between the 1970s and 2000, and that showed that the trend for miscarriages had increased over the decades. And at that point, it was established that it was really due to early home testing and early detection, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then since then, the rates have been about the same. They hover increasing a percent, decreasing a percent. Depends on which country you're living in. But, you know, the risk factors have been essentially the same. And some of the things that are more prevalent in our society, things like obesity, tend to add to that list of risk factors.
So do you find that we talk about it enough, though? Because I know, you know, in my family personally, we've, as I mentioned before, my husband and I have dealt with a miscarriage. My own mom has dealt with miscarriages. So we've heard of it. I have had friends who have literally lost children, have had stillbirth children. So I have seen it firsthand, and I've experienced it firsthand. But I think as a society, there's still this unbelievable stigma of guilt and shame and I failed and my body doesn't work. You know,
Absolutely. How
do we break that? Why isn't that being talked about? I guess it's being talked about more than it was generations ago. But how do we break that stigma?
It's really devastating. It's one of the hardest things that I have to do during my work days to tell a woman that she's lost a baby. Because, you know, as women, as soon as we know that we're pregnant, that's our child. We don't think of it as, oh, this is a 6-week embryo. This is our baby. And so most women, pregnancy is such an anticipated thing, don't even think that they could have a pregnancy loss. There is, as you said, more awareness now because women are coming out of the woodwork to talk about it. If you're a woman that's suffering a loss and you go home and you tell your friends and family, women pour out and tell you that they've been through the same thing. And that's so important. The conversation is so important. And I think that's why raising awareness, what you're doing, is essential, because there should be no stigma attached to it. Frequently, the pregnancy losses that happen are related to chromosomal abnormalities. You know, up to 70% of early pregnancy losses are related or caused by that. There's nothing that you or I or any woman can do to really prevent that. There should be no shame. So part of talking to a woman when you're taking care of her when she does have a loss is letting her know that there's very little that she could do to prevent this or could have done to prevent this because there's not much that you can do to prevent a chromosomal abnormality from happening again. Unfortunately, your risk for a pregnancy loss, if you've had one, for the next pregnancy is a little bit higher. We see it more frequently in women who've had previous losses, but truly it's about talking, it's about counseling, it's about letting our women, our patients know that there's support out there, hooking them up with grief counseling, getting them therapists, encouraging them to talk to other women in their circle about what they've been through. I find that women are so good at supporting each other, but you have to start the conversation. You have to go out there and talk to the people who love you. And as providers, as physicians, it's our job to make sure that once you make the diagnosis, you don't leave the woman high and dry. You have to be there to kind of carry her through it.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Dr. Ronica Chowdhury, who we're talking a lot about pregnancy loss. It's a very common thing, and October marks National Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month. Dr. Chowdhury, even if you do everything right, how do we address the fact that things sometimes just go wrong sometimes? I look at my own pregnancy with my son, who, thank God, was born healthy. I would call a perfect pregnancy. I was healthy. I barely gained any weight. I worked out 4 times a week. I ate healthy. I had no cravings. Like, I thought I crushed pregnancy, if I'm being honest. Then I had my son. Yeah, I felt I crushed it. I got to be honest. But then I had my son, and my body could not actually, it could not work. It could not get my son out accurately. I had to go into an emergency C-section. My son ended up, thank God, getting out in time where he didn't run out of fluid or anything. But I almost lost my life on the table. In fact, they could not get my bleeding under control. And I was in an operating room for a couple hours, actually, to get everything under control. And the thing that replays in my head now, then a year later, going through a miscarriage myself, is that I don't understand, because I did everything the doctors told me to do. I was what I would call, like, picture perfect for a pregnancy, a young pregnancy, and still things went wrong.
There's nothing that there are some things that you absolutely have no control over, Melissa, not you and not your physicians. Sometimes it's how the baby comes down. Sometimes it's a cord wrapped around the baby. Sometimes there's the increased vascularity during surgery when a woman is pregnant. All those complications, they're not common, but they certainly do happen. And I don't think that a woman should take responsibility for what you went through. It's not something that you could have controlled. It's disheartening, I think, when you realize that so much happens to our bodies as women, things that we really have no control over. You know, an early loss with chromosomal abnormalities, I can't do anything about that, neither can my patient. Complications during surgery, or a baby deciding to cooperate and come down the birth canal properly, or a heart rate that's dropping and causing an emergency cesarean, those are things that you can control. But thankfully, you know, if you're in good hands and in a good setting, in a good hospital, you're able to get the care that you need, that at the end, the outcome is positive, that you're well and your baby's well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the hardest thing about obstetrics, I find, is that there's so, you can do everything right as a patient and as a provider, as a physician, but it just doesn't always lead to the outcome or the course of action or path that you would want it to.
Mm-hmm. Some of the risks you take when you want to become a parent.
Yeah.
I always
tell my patients that the hardest thing about, you know, the thing that you learn the most when you have babies and get pregnant and deliver is that your children are in charge. They make the rules. They decide how your life is going to go.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth? Dr. Chowdhury, I know that we were just talking about how sometimes, even if you check all the boxes, you look like you're doing great, that sometimes things are just not going to go the way that they planned. Heck, there's nothing that goes as planned. Let's be honest. Nothing goes as planned. But sometimes the outcomes are not as rosy as we would like them to be in a pregnancy. But what would you suggest? What are some of the best ways that we can give ourselves the greatest chance of having a healthy pregnancy?
I think that the way to optimize any pregnancy to the best of our ability is to make sure that you're in good health, that you've talked to your obstetrician maybe even before conceiving, especially if you've had a pregnancy loss previously. But, you know, women, as they get older, they have an increased risk of miscarriages. Wanting to correct things like diabetes, even if you have type 1 diabetes, making sure your sugars are controlled optimally. If you're overweight, trying to be healthy with good eating habits and exercise and losing some weight, making sure if you have a thyroid disorder that it's managed and that your numbers look great, your levels are good. you know, stress is so multifactorial in how it affects an early pregnancy, but trying to manage your stress as best as you can, especially in such stressful times. And then just, you know, being as healthy as you can, sometimes a structural thing. So go in and talk to your obstetrician if you're trying to have a baby and make sure that everything checks out okay so that you can maximize your healthy outcome. You know, and then it's been so hard. The one thing I did want to mention, Melissa, is that with COVID, what we've noticed, because it's so limited, you know, having support people when women come in for their office visits mm-hmm. or even when they deliver babies, that a lot of women in the last few months have had to suffer this loss alone. And it's been devastating for them and devastating for us to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, if your partner hasn't been in to confirm that pregnancy and see that first ultrasound and you come back for the second one, and there is no heartbeat and you're still by yourself, it's been so difficult for women, and then difficult for the partners because they've never really had a chance to truly attach to that pregnancy sometimes because they've not been involved in the process. Mm. So, you know, we don't know when this pandemic is going to change course and get better. We hope sooner than later. But I think that if you're out there trying to have a baby, go see your obstetrician, make sure you're in the healthiest condition possible. See if there's any recommendations that they need to make so that you can improve your health and hopefully the outcome. And if you're going through a loss, talk to the women in your life because they will help support you. Talk to your doctors so they can link you with support groups. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be alone, even though we feel so isolated through this time.
Mm-hmm. I know I've certainly felt that way. And it's amazing how once you get the words out and you could say it, how it's true what you said earlier on, that you would be so surprised as to how many people can relate.
When you come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Now, Doc, before I let you go, there was one more thing I wanted to touch on, and that is the idea of like a ticking time. You know, you've got moms who want to have careers, which I think is great. I'm one of those, a working mom. But, you know, there are people who get into their upper 30s, even lower 40s, I would say, and they worry because for so long you think to yourself, well, the older I get, the harder it's going to be to have a healthy pregnancy. What is the truth behind that? What should people know this morning? If they're not having kids in their 20s, they're waiting till their 30s. Is that okay?
I mean, it's okay because life for women is very different now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we do know that age is a risk, increasing age is a risk factor for miscarriages, for early pregnancy loss. And typically we say that, you know, around 35 years of age is when that risk starts to go up. So if it's possible, have babies before then, but it's not always possible. Your risk of a loss is higher, but that doesn't mean that you can't go on to have a healthy pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Dr. Ronica Chowdhury, I always appreciate having you on the air this morning. Is there anything else that our audience should know about or any places that they should go if they, like you said, want those resources, want to be able to talk to somebody, maybe professional before they go to someone personal about a miscarriage or something like that? Is there somewhere they could go that you'd recommend?
I think that depending on where you're located geographically, there's a lot of support groups. There's a lot of national groups, national registries that you can reach out to. There's counselors online, hotlines that you can talk to, but talk to your doctors. They're your first line of defense. They're the ones that should be taking care of you, helping you link to therapists, giving you the numbers that you need for the support when you have a miscarriage. Don't do it by yourself.
Okay. Dr. Ronica Chowdhury, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll talk again really soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Congressman Heim, so glad you're here this morning. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm just fine. Thank you.
Okay. So, you know, we're going to talk about the stimulus relief package, right? we got to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, because we've been doing that for the last 7 or 8 weeks.
Yeah. So we got to talk about this because this week has been, I would say, all over the place, to put it simply. It's very confusing, to be honest. So just to backtrack, I know our listeners are very up on their politics, but earlier this week, President Trump wanted to delay the stimulus deal until after the election to focus on a Supreme Court nomination until after he was elected. Of course, some people will see that as his own election agenda, but other sources have said that he wasn't for the initial stimulus plan of $2.4 trillion because because it included add-ons that weren't connected to COVID-19, which were being pushed by Speaker Pelosi. It sounded like the president was good with a $1.6 trillion deal initially, and then he backed off of it. Of course, he has since gone back to wanting money for small businesses. So here's the quick question. What is the latest this morning? What's going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, you characterize it exactly right. You know, not all of us get to negotiate, massive stimulus bills in our lives. But, it's not hard for an American to understand what would happen if you were about to buy a house and the seller said, under no circumstances am I letting you buy it, and then tweeted that maybe you could buy parts of it, and then tweeted that maybe we should sell the whole thing. We're getting incredibly inconsistent information. And look, it's there for everybody to see on the president's Twitter feed. And so that's making it very, very hard to negotiate. The key issue here, Melissa, and I'll just start with the headline. Look, the talks are not dead yet. I was on a call with Speaker Pelosi yesterday. They continue to talk, Steve Mnuchin and the Speaker in particular. There's really two issues, right? Remember, Pelosi's first gambit, what we passed in the House probably 3 months ago, was a really big deal. It was over $3 trillion in size. And yeah, look, it had a lot of stuff in there that I would be very comfortable living without, but it was the initial opening in a negotiation, which never really happened, right? I mean, months went by before Mitch McConnell or the president showed any interest in sort of having that conversation. So now, Speaker Pelosi is down to a bill that we passed last Friday, just over $2 trillion in size. And we're just getting inconsistent messages from the other side about whether they even want to do a deal. So there's two things at stake that are still sort of under contention. One, it sounds like the president was willing to do something in the neighborhood of $1.6 trillion. It's not clear that Mitch McConnell is willing to do that. So that's one issue. The other issue, of course, is the president is really hung up on, and you can see this in his Twitter feed, what he calls aid to blue states. It's making me a little crazy because states and towns and cities have across the country have fired over a million of their workers. We're talking about firefighters and police officers and teachers, because their revenues aren't coming in. And the president believes that, as he calls it, that's a blue state bailout. In reality, every state in the union, red or blue, is having real trouble because guess what? People can't pay their property taxes or an economic activity is down. So sales taxes aren't coming in. So those are the big outstanding issues. And look, my fingers are crossed, right? I mean, here in Fairfield County, every day I encounter small businesses that feel like they're 2 weeks away from having to close, or people who, continue to be unemployed since March. So there's a huge need out there.
So that's the thing that I wanted to kind of dive into a little bit more, which you kind of touched on, is his claims that Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she wants to add money to this package that he's calling not COVID related. But you're saying that these states that she wants to, quote, bail out, or that's what he's calling it, bailing them out. You're saying these are towns and cities specifically that have shown that they're the ones suffering the most, or they've had to fire the most people. Is that what you're saying?
Well, in terms of the president's charge that there's non-COVID related money in there, look, in the first bill, what was known as the Heroes Bill, which was a very big deal, a very big bill, as I said, over $3 trillion in size. I think there were things in there, not unrelated, but that I would, that you could take out, and certainly I wouldn't object. There was a provision to reduce American student debt by $10,000 a student, right? Now, we can have a long conversation about student debt and what a tragedy that is for a lot of people. But, you could say that that's not immediately going to fix somebody's COVID-related problems.
Sure.
But the latest negotiations, the latest deal are very, very directly COVID-related monies. But this issue, the president just thinks that money that would go to all of the states, and, here in Connecticut, we've taken millions of dollars to help our hospitals, to help our state police, to help, the president just can't stop thinking about that as something that's going to benefit blue states. And that's a big hang up.
What is the difference, again, talking to Congressman Jim Himes this morning? So the 1.6 that the president wanted to put forward versus the 2.4 that Speaker Pelosi has been talking about. So what is that difference in money? Like, where if we don't pass a stimulus bill that has the 2.4 versus the 1.6, who's missing out?
Yeah, good question. And again, we got to remember, in one tweet, the president said maybe the 1.6 was okay. But then later on, he said, I'm shutting it all down and just confirming a Supreme Court justice. So one of the big problems there is we really don't know. President is not putting his shoulder to the wheel in any consistent way.
Back and say that he's back on the table with wanting to do? Didn't he say like the next day that he was looking to get back into negotiations with this?
Well, in the last 48 hours, we've basically heard every position from the president. And, you know, again, you can just check his Twitter feed and you can kind of see why this is a difficult negotiation. But your question is a good one. In my opinion, a $1.5, $1.6 trillion does the trick. It's probably not as robust as it should be in a couple of areas, but guess what? I'm willing to compromise. 1.6 would be – it would be three things. It would be three really important things. I think most Americans understand how important all three of these things are. Number one, it would be a complete reauthorization and kind of refunding, if you will, of the PPP program. That's the business. That's the aid to small businesses, largely grants, right? That would be number one. Number two would be a replenishment of unemployment insurance so that people who are out of work could get those checks that they need. It would probably involve airline relief, right? The airlines are in the process of laying off a lot of their employees. And the third thing is what we've been talking about, which would be aid to states and municipalities. To me, that feels like the right combination. Probably not quite big enough, but again, you know, the art of government involves compromise.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Congressman Jim Himes, we're obviously going to keep a very close eye on this developing news out of Washington, D.C. I know a lot of people continue to call in to me almost on a daily basis asking when they're going to get some more relief. And obviously, we don't have that answer right now.
Yep.
We don't have that from a federal standpoint. So, Congressman Himes, we always appreciate getting your weigh-in on things, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.